Viking believes that a journey on the rivers of the world can be an experience designed for the thinking person. Viking, exploring the world in comfort. Learn more at viking.com.
Learn how to plan, invest, and live smarter with the Raymond James For What It's Worth podcast. Featuring insights from leading professionals, you'll get the latest in wealth management, market commentary, and engaging research. Listen today at raymondjames.com/podcast.
I'm Jace Lacob, and you're listening to Masterpiece Studio. On episode 3 of Flesh and Blood, the investigation into what happened the night of Vivian's birthday party intensifies, as D.I. Lynam has a new witness in the hot seat, Vivian's troublemaker son, Jake.
And when it all went wrong, did you try to help the victim in any way?
Yeah, of course I tried. Of course I tried. It just happened really quickly and we was all in shock, weren't we?
But like the rest of his siblings, Jake's got his own problems beyond a potential murder to worry about. For starters, he's trying to convince his wife to let him move back home.
That letter must have taken you ages. I know how much you hate writing, so I was really touched. Thanks. And listen, you know, about that guy. I've seen him twice. But, well, twice is enough, shall we say?
Still, romantic failures haven't prevented Jake from nosing around his new stepfather's personal life, trying to find proof that the good doctor is less innocent than he seems.
Look, I'm telling you, the more you dig around, the worse it gets.
Jake, slow down, for God's sake. Have you double-checked this before we get all...
Flesh and Blood star Russell Tovey knows just exactly what Jake did and where his amateur detective work ends, and he joins us to discuss toxic masculinity, his trademark ears, and his own artistic podcast adventures. This week we are joined by Flesh and Blood star Russell Tovey. Welcome.
How you doing?
You've said that as an actor, you like domestic dramas. What was it about the role of Jake that attracted you to Flesh and Blood in the script stage?
Well, when it comes to domestic dramas, Jake, he's basically a mummy's boy. So he has another son relationship. He misses his dad desperately, who died 18 months previously. He's got two sisters who... they have a very much love-hate relationship. He's in a relationship, but he's having an affair with someone else. So for me, if I'm looking for domestic relationships, Jake was the antithesis of everything you could be hopeful to explore.
I want to dive into those issues you mentioned in a bit that are plaguing Jake specifically. But do you see this character as perhaps representing a form of toxic masculinity?
100%. He's been enabled all his life by his mother, by his sisters, to be a kind of drifter. He's a trainer. He's got a job. He's a personal trainer, and he does well at that. But he is also someone that is slightly stunted in his growth emotionally. I think the death of his dad has completely screwed him up and not allowed him an opportunity to... You know, I think his dad was such a big presence that it didn't mean that he had to man up or be the man of the house, which is like what he feels like the masculine role should be with toxic masculinity, with like playing up to gender norms. But it feels like his dad died and then he feels like he should be able to man up. But he's lost his wife and kids because he squandered all the money on betting. He hasn't got any money to rent a nice apartment so he can have the kids because the social worker doesn't think it's acceptable. He's in a really weird position where he's a guy in his 30s who should be able to support his family and should be a role model for everyone in his life, and he's not, and he can't admit it. So yes, there is a lot of toxic masculinity within Jake, which for a performer, which for an actor, was glorious to explore.
I mean, as an actor, you don't always have to like the character that you play on screen, but do you feel a sense of sympathy towards Jake?
I don't feel sympathetic for him. I enjoyed playing him because he's just a dick, if we can say that. He's just like, he's just a bit of an idiot, and he's very righteous and feels like his opinions are the right opinion. If he thinks it, it has to be true. He is also someone that is completely misguided by his morals. He would judge someone else, but yet he would do exactly the same himself and feel like that's appropriate. His treatment of the women in his life when it comes to, you know, his wife, his ex-wife, then gets back with the woman who is personal training, then she pays him to be his gigolo. He acts like a child and takes no responsibility for any of his actions. And that is such a joy to play, that someone who you know, from the outside, you know they're wrong. But from the inside, playing from the inside, he's so determined at how right he is.
Do you feel then that we start to see Jake grow up in these first three episodes to finally begin to accept responsibility and maybe move towards changing himself for the better?
No. I feel like he's someone who's completely in denial, and then this man comes into his mother's life and takes over his father's role that for his mother, and that for him is poison. That for him completely emasculates him, completely holds a mirror up that he doesn't want to look in, and he doesn't learn. And he also, as a family, they don't communicate. They argue, they bicker, but they don't know anything about each other. His two sisters are going through huge events in their life, huge events, and they don't know about it. They don't share it with their siblings. They keep this facade up and this pride that they don't want to show any weakness to each other. So it's such a toxic situation for all of them to be in, because there's not any authentic ability to express yourself.
Because there are no shortage of secrets in this family, between the siblings especially, there's innate conflict between the three of them, whether it's sort of financial. They seem to latch on to Natalie having had help from their father to get her first flat. I mean, how do you categorize Jake's relationship to his sisters, given those walls that exist between them? Is, as you say, is there any authenticity there?
Well, I think there's a lot of sibling relationships authentic. I think it's completely genuine, where siblings don't really know each other. There is a sort of social contract that you have with your family, that you have a politeness, that you talk. So there is that there, but he's the baby. Jake's the baby. Jake's the one that's been allowed to be little Jake, little naughty Jake. It's funny, isn't it? And, you know, there is a competitiveness and a jealousy with his sisters. And for Jake, again, his two sisters are successful. They've got money. And one of them's been helped out, even though they're a success, by the father. He didn't get helped out. So again, there's more emasculating that's happened from his sisters. So it's coming from all angles. He's been exposed. His raw, kind of really sensitive underbelly is completely exposed the whole time. And it feels like everybody's just prodding it and scratching at it.
Welcome to the most awkward birthday drinks in the history of the world.
Yeah, it's not funny though, is it?
Have you been drinking?
Why? Have you?
How different would you say is their dynamic to that between you and Claudie Blakely and Lydia Leonard?
Oh, my God. Well, we were the three sisters. That's what we called ourselves on set. We had the most wonderful time together. Those two people are just... Everybody on this was just so lovely. And the director, Louise Hooper, there were so many really positive female role models, female performers, female talent involved on all different layers of this. There was so, the producer was female. There were so many members of the crew. It felt really exciting. I really love the company of women when it comes to like my life. My best mates are girls. I've always been gravitated towards girls. So for me to have these two wonderful people as part of my family in this show, and to be around them the whole time, was just a joy. I adore them.
Those scenes with the three siblings feel really lived in. Claudie spoke about the fact that Louise Hooper would allow you guys to speak over each other in the group scenes. How did that, and the ability to do some improvising, allow you to deepen the relationship between the siblings?
Well, that never happens. In real life, we all talk over each other the whole time. But when you're filming, it never happens, because the sound person will come in and be like, can you just not talk over each other because it affects the sound? So you don't ever get the ability or the option to access that free flow of your inner monologue or just improvise freely. I love improv. Those two love improv. So to be told, go with this, talk over each other was just a dream, because you had so much fun, and so many times we cracked each other up with things we were saying, because under your breath you would say something and the other ones would hear it. It's a wonderful way to act, because the constraints of a script are brilliant, but to be able to like add some sparkle and glitter is really a gift.
You have a brother. Did you draw on any real-life sibling rivalry or dynamics to use during shooting?
Yeah, I guess I thought about whenever you're crafting a character, you want to do the research and you want to know who these people are and their relationships. And in your head, you picture them going on holiday together, or you picture them birthdays, or like at school. Did you talk to each other at school? Was you at the same school when they first got boyfriends, when you first got a girlfriend, all them sort of stories for the character to craft. So in my head, you always have to draw on your own personal experiences. And I would put things back to like situations where me and my brother have had conflicts, or we bonded, or we've been there for each other, or like I've pissed him off, or I broke his remote control car, or I threw a hot dog at him as a kid, or stuff like that to real events that I'm able to then in my head project them onto the sisters, project them onto scenarios in my head to build a narrative and a background, which I think I do with everything. I think you always, as an actor, you draw on your own personal journey, life lessons, and then you are able to kind of carve them into these characters you're inhabiting.
You're an avid gym goer. Were you thrilled to be thought of as buff enough to be cast as a personal trainer?
Yeah, but there's also the pressure of like, you really have to kind of up your game if you're playing a PT. It felt nice to be like considered for that casting, yeah. But also with Jake, I feel like he's someone that would have abused steroids younger in his life, and then it's sort of let it go a little bit now because he's not got his wife anymore, or he settled with his wife, and then it was like he was became a gambler, so that became his fixation. So I feel for him, I wanted him to have a gym toned body, but I also didn't want him to be like someone that really watches what they eat, doesn't have a drink on that level. I didn't want him to make like Instagram hungry, like Instagram thirst gym body. I don't feel like Jake is on Instagram. I think he might have it, but rarely posts anything. I don't think he even thinks about that. So I wanted him to have an authentic kind of gym body, but the one that wasn't too ridiculous.
Jake is very much firmly opposed to his mother Vivian's new romance with Mark Keneally. Why does he take such a strong, immediate dislike to Mark, and how is that tied up in his unresolved feelings towards his late father?
I just think it's the fact that you're imagining your mum having sex again. I think it's, you know when you realise your teacher is actually a human being with like a family at home, and they don't just turn into androids at the end of the school day. They go home and they have their life. It's like that thing when you realize, oh my God, my mother is a person and she's a sexual being, and now she's blossoming and she's twinkling and she's with this guy who's come out of nowhere, who's a threat to me. Jake doesn't like the thought of his mum having pleasure, basically, which is so selfish. He wants her to play the role of mum, and that's it. She's my mum. You need to be there for me. You need to support me. You're my mum. And when he realizes that he's losing his mother figure and he's lost his father figure already to someone else who's come out of nowhere, that's not what was meant to happen for Jake. Jake was meant to have mum there, mummy's boy forever, and now he doesn't. And that for him is a massive no-no.
Which is so interesting to me because he's a parent himself. Like, he exists as a person separate from his own children, but he can't give his own mother the benefit of that.
He can't learn from his own life lessons. He has no ability to see himself in someone else's shoes. He's for quite a selfish thing. It's very much about him. Poor Jake. Poor Jake. Poor Jake. Poor Jake. Another drink. He feels he's so. He has such a determination, but he also feels such a privilege. He feels like he's privileged and he deserves whatever he wants, and when he doesn't get it, it's quite tough. But saying that, what he is as a father is amazing. The love he has for his kids, his relationship with his kids, the importance that his kids play with him is so much. But he just can't see how the next generation up, his relationship with his mom, how that can be so different.
I mean, his relationship to his kids, I think, is his sort of one redeeming quality. He has such love for his kids. He pulls his son out of the street when he's about to get hit by a car.
Yes, Stella, I get you.
No! No! Oh, what are you doing?
When you get how much he loves his kids, what happened between Jake and Layla exactly?
Well, so Jake and Layla were happy, but Jake was squandering all of their rent and their savings on betting and drinking. And he was a gambling addict. He is a gambling addict. And he didn't tell her. And he thought he could get the big win and then cover it up. And then he was draining the funds till it got to the point where they had their money and the house they shared. The kids had bedrooms. Layla had to move back in with her own mum with the kids because they couldn't afford the rent anymore. And he did that and they had money and he did it all when he lied. And he lied and lied and lied and he kept it all a secret and he hid everything from her thinking he could sort it out. And then it got too far and his world fell apart and he was exposed and she saw that. And that is deceit and lack of the trust is completely broken. And it's the fact that you could just so willfully take money from your children. It's, you know, from your children's like health. That is the most shocking thing that Layla thought. So she was like, I loved you and I trusted you and you've broken us.
Before this next question, a brief word from our sponsors. Ocean voyages, expeditions, river journeys. Viking is dedicated to bringing travelers closer to the destination, offering a small ship experience and a shore excursion in every port. Learn more at viking.com. Coming up next on Masterpiece on PBS, Mr. Bates versus the Post Office continues Sunday at 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Central, followed by the finale of Alice and Jack at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. Central. Jake falls into we'll call it a transactional relationship with his personal training client, Stella, that's at once purely sexual, but also deeply personal. What does Stella offer him apart from a rent-free flat and money?
I think Stella offers him a positive role model. She offers him friendship. She offers him respect. She starts developing feelings for him. And for him, she taps into a maternal side. Even though it turns sexual, there is a maternal, like the older lady giving him advice.
I understand that while we're both separated, it is none of my business who you choose to see.
It is none of but what?
No, she'll appreciate that, trust me. But that doesn't mean I don't care. I do. And I hope with all my heart.
I wouldn't say that.
I hope with all my heart that we can put our marriage back together.
Marriage back together. Heart. Okay, that's good. That's really good.
Yeah, I love you.
Hang on. Together. What was that?
I love you.
Love you.
Jake.
Kiss. Two kisses. Three kisses. Well, that's good. That's brilliant. That's genius.
They really respect each other, and I think they really get on well, and it's fun. And in a parallel world, they would probably be together because they actually have this really beautiful connection. But he's just too immature to really realize what he's got with Layla and what he's got with Stella. He's so spoiled and entitled. But what she does for him is kind of make him a better person without him even realizing. She makes him think and stop and analyze and consider the feelings of other people.
I know we're supposed to root for Jake and Layla to work it out, but I personally love Jake and Stella together, despite the, you know, prostitution aspect of their relationship. Jake's on the house offer in this episode I thought was priceless. despite himself, is Jake falling for Stella as well? Does he have feelings for her?
Yeah, I think he deeply cares for her, and it sort of caught him off guard. I don't think he was ready for this, but in his head, he wants to get back with his wife. That's what he's decided. He needs to be a dad with his kids. He needs to see them. So this experience he's having, these emotional connections he's got with Stella, he's not emotionally mature enough to realize that it's more than a folly. That's something that I think, you know, years down the road or months down the road, he'll realize that what he actually had with this lady.
What was it like working with Sharon Small in these scenes together?
I adore her. I mean, everyone, and again, another powerhouse actress, magic. I mean, I was spoiled with all of these incredible actors, actresses on this production. But, you know, we had so many intimate scenes, and she's just fantastic, and she's brilliant. And it felt really easy and calm and fun. At every moment, this was fun. This was one of them shows where it didn't ever, you know, and we filmed it during the summer in a beautiful area of the UK called Eastbourne, and with this amazing family home, and we was in this great hotel night afterwards. It was really like this old, like, Edwardian hotel that was built in the heyday of Eastbourne. It just had like a really beautiful feeling around the whole thing, and it was warm, and it just felt special. And I think Sharon Small is a really special performer and person.
Jake is in the hot seat in this episode being interrogated by D.I. Lynam. There's the briefest moment when Lynam pushes about Vivian's collapse and health, where Jake appears to show genuine emotion, possibly for the first time in the show.
I understand your mother had always enjoyed good health.
Mum always kept herself fit as a fiddle.
So her collapse, I mean, that must have come as a shock.
Yeah, it did. She made every effort to get better, but it wasn't like her. So, yes, of course, we were concerned. One more.
Why is this moment so significant, and what triggers this reaction?
Because the thought of losing his mum is unbearable. So anything that relates to her demise, to her in a vulnerable position, completely incomprehensible to him. And also the fear of what Mark is doing, and the mix up with Mark and his mum, and how that plays into the mix. But yet he can't admit stuff like that to, at that stage where he's being investigated, where he's being like interviewed by the police. He's not in a position to offer up the opportunity to frame Mark, because stuff's happened that he has to kind of fudge and cover up.
Jake is deeply suspicious of Mark and seizes on the mystery of Mark's daughter, Sophie, pushing Vivian for more information about her. Does he believe that Sophie is an invention of Mark's, that he's conjured up this mystery daughter?
Everything about Mark is a mystery. Everything about Mark is a lie. This guy has come out of nowhere and suddenly he's completely ingrained into his mother's life. He's not great. And then when you read that his ex-wife committed suicide, as a protective son, as a protective family, that's not a good thing to read about. There's no like redeeming qualities in Mark that the kids can see that would allow him to pass the audition of potentially being their mother's mate. They wouldn't choose him for her on any level. They wouldn't choose anyone for her. But if they were to choose anyone, it certainly would not be Mark.
We begin to see more of the birthday drinks evening. We know now there was a fist fight between Mark and Jake. Jake's knuckles are bruised, and he involuntarily clenches his fist during the interrogation. There's still one episode to go, and I'm sure there's a few twists along the way, but has Lynam caught his man in this moment?
I think Jake's a lot cleverer and convincing and manipulating than the audience might appreciate. I think he's someone that's been able to lie to his wife and kids and keep up a facade that everything's okay to his family for many years. So the opportunity to tell a lie to protect himself is not uncharted territory for him.
Mm. What do you make of Jake and Mary's relationship? Why has she maintained such a powerful role in the family after all of these years?
I think Mary is someone that does so much for the family. She's a sweet lady that would... She's the sort of person that if you went to your mum, I want to get my ear pierced, she'd be like, you're not getting your ears pierced. And then you go to Mary's and Mary would be like, I'll take you to get your ear pierced. Do you know what I mean? She feels like she's sort of like the cheeky mum, the fun mum, the one that sort of will look after you and cook you your favourite meal whenever you want. Or like the nan. She feels like the nan, the grandmother. Like the mum can't do that, but granny can do that. And I think she's been such a presence in their life as a next door neighbour. And it feels like they all share a lot more of themselves with Mary than they seem to do with each other.
You played Leslie Durrell opposite Imelda Staunton in My Family and Other Animals. What was it like reuniting with her after all of this time?
Oh, it's the best. I love Meldy. Moldy Stilton. She's so brilliant. And, you know, I just finished the History Boys movie before we were going around the world, and we shot that in Corfu for like 6 weeks, 5 weeks or something. And it was just hanging out with her. She's just such a laugh and such a brilliant, you know, we all know, the amazing actress. But as a person, again, just so fun and open and warm and loves the gossip. If you need to have a serious chat, she'll go for a serious chat. She's a really special person. And to then have her attached to this project when we was doing the castings and everything was just like, when you get that name attached, then you know you're onto something really special.
What can you tease about what lies ahead in this final episode for Jake?
I think for Jake, you're going to see a man challenged beyond anything he'd ever considered he'd be challenged with. I think at this point in his life, he thought he'd be breezing through, lots of money, happy family, going on holidays, big car. He's an infantilized adult. He's a man child that is trying his best to grow up, but it's a struggle.
It's a rare journalistic portrait of you that doesn't mention your ears. The Independent once deemed them, quote, Prince Charles ears. How do you feel about your ears, and have you learned to love them as much as your fans do?
I have always loved them. I've never had an issue with my ears at all. Even as a kid, when I got called wingnut and big ears and airplane and like car doors and all of them things, it never ever occurred to me at any point that I would have to pin them back. And multiple people over my career as an actor have said to me, if you want to make it in Hollywood, if you want to do well, you need to get your ears pinned back. And I've always said, nah, I'm not gonna, this is me, this is my trademark, I'm not gonna do that. And I think having, you know, my parents were very much like, your ears are you. And they are, and I forget about it. And then when people mention it, I'm like, oh yeah, I've got sticky out ears. Because they're not actually big, they just stick out. That's the misconception, is that people think they're big. They're not big, they're just pokey.
You are no stranger to the world of podcasting, as you host your own podcast, Talk Art, with gallerist Robert Diament, now in its seventh season. What was the impetus behind starting the podcast, and how does it continue to bring you joy?
The impetus was just, I'm an art geek. That's my absolute passion outside of acting. And it gave us the access to talk to our heroes and to be geeks and geek off on a regular basis was the most joyful thing that has happened with this podcast. And the thing about art and the thing about culture and creative people is that it's limitless. So this podcast is limitless. It's not like we reach it and we complete the game of podcasting. There is no completion. There is no big bad boss at the end. There's big bad guests we want on, but there's no big bad boss you have to beat and then it's over. This is something that we can hopefully, touch wood, continue for many, many years to come and create a time capsule for all of this. It's like before COVID, during COVID, I can't wait for it to be post-COVID. This is something like a record of culture of our time. And hopefully in years to come, when we're all dead and buried, it's going to be something that people harness, archive, and keep for prosperity and teach in schools.
earlier this year, you were to star as Nick in the Broadway revival of Edward Albee's Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, which was canceled when Broadway shut down amid the pandemic. How difficult was it to shut down, and how do you think live theater will adapt post-pandemic?
It was incredibly sad. We did 5 weeks rehearsal, 8 previews. It was going really well. We had amazing audience responses. But when we shut down, it felt like there was something bigger in the world, and it felt right to leave the city for a while. We were hoping it was only going to be like 3 weeks to a month. They said to us, you're going to have to come back in about 3 weeks so we can re-rehearse, get back in. We were like, fine. And then it just never happened. But what the feeling was overall is that it's kind of like superfluous right now, because there feels like this really terrible thing that's just looming. And it was, it is, we're in it. It's like taken over the globe. Who could have ever predicted, apart from Rusty Davis and years, that something like this would happen in our lifetime? You read about it in books. You read about the plague in books. You read about history. We're living history right now. So theatre-wise, I'm of the camp that if you can sit on an aeroplane with a mask, on a packed aeroplane for 4 or 5 hours, 6 hours, 7 hours, why can't you sit in the theatre for an hour and a half with a mask and do social distancing? I'm like, get the theatres open, give people the opportunity, give the spaces between them, split the seats up, seat it differently, position it differently, do one-man shows, do performances where everyone's wearing a mask. I don't know, but just, we've got to get live theatre back up. And there's lots of theatres here that are adapting, and that's what art is that artists don't sit and wait for it to blow over and go back to what's happened before. Artists adapt, and I find that really inspiring.
You mentioned History Boys. Alan Bennett's History Boys was a major turning point for you. You starred in both the stage and film versions of the play. What did you learn from Alan Bennett?
I learned from Alan Bennett so much when it comes to literature and education. From the day one of rehearsals, we sat down and they said, Nick Heitner and Alan Bennett, the director, and Nick Alan Bennett, the writer, said, look, if there's nothing off limits here, there's nothing out of bounds. If you think something sounds stupid in your head, just say it. There's no question that's wrong. And we were like bombarded with literature from that show. That stuff we don't know. And I actually watched it in lockdown, the movie, and I hadn't seen it since the premiere like 14 years ago. And the stuff in the movie, I mean, I was crying throughout for nostalgia reasons, but there's stuff in the movie that I was like, oh, that's what that means. Oh, I get that now, because I'm that bit older, or I've experienced life a bit more, or I've had my heart broken, or I've seen this, or I've known someone that's done that. And suddenly it even come more alive. So it's a timeless piece that will keep evolving and growing. But Alan just gifted us boys an opportunity to be a part of something that was incredibly special.
You're from Billericay. Your History Boys co-star James Corden would go on to co-create and star in Gavin and Stacey, where you played Budgie in 4 episodes. What was the atmosphere like on the show, which would go on to become one of the most beloved British comedies of all time?
Fun, easy. I mean, we was on Broadway and History Boys when he got it greenlit. And then he said to me and Sam Anderson and Andy Knott, did we want to be the Stags? Did we want to be like Gavin and Smithy's mates from Essex? And we were like, yeah. So we shot the first season and we did our episodes. And nobody knew at that point the enormity of what the show would be. Nobody knew at that point what it was going to become. So when we went back to the second season, it was suddenly like, wow, we're into something. But the second season hit. That's when the show went stratospheric. And it changed, you know, lives. And I would go back to Essex. I'm actually from Billericay. So the reason it's set in Billericay, Essex, is because I talked about Billericay, Essex all the time. So James got this like idea in his head that it was Billericay. So I would go back there and people would say to me, oi, Budgie, you're a legend. And I'd be like, this is nuts. This is so nuts. It was a brilliant, amazing show to be a part of, and I'm so proud of James, what he achieved, and to have been on that journey with him.
Russell Tovey, thank you so very much.
Thank you so much. It's so nice to talk to you.
There's but one episode remaining of Flesh and Blood, and viewers must be wondering what exactly happened at Vivian's birthday party by the sea.
Did you feel that she had perhaps rushed into her new marriage?
No, not really. I mean, at that point, well, there was no way of knowing that it would all end in such an appalling way.
Who is the murder victim and who is the killer? The Who Done What comes to a close as series creator Sarah Williams joins us here on the podcast October 25th for a full debrief of the case at hand. Masterpiece Studio is hosted by me, Jace Lacob, and produced by Nick Anderson. Elishaba Itoop is our editor. Rebecca Eaton is the executive producer at large of Masterpiece. The executive producer of Masterpiece is Suzanne Simpson. Sponsors for Masterpiece on PBS are Viking Cruises, Raymond James, and the Masterpiece Trust. Masterpiece Studio is officially a Webby Awards nominee for 2024. We are honored to be considered among such talented competition, but we need your vote. Head over to vote.webbyawards.com and vote for Masterpiece Studio in the podcast section, where you'll find us listed in the general television and film category. Voting closes Thursday, April 18th, so be sure to get your vote in soon. That's vote.webbyawards.com. Thank you.